Our theme for November is Ministering to Families in Crisis, and here on Shaping Special Hearts, we like to particularly focus on families that have a child with a special need. And my special guest today is going to really help us tap into some incredible ministry for that. And her name is Jolene Philo. Jolene was a teacher for 25 years in her first life, in her first job, and then she began writing in 2003. And since then, she has published articles on parenting for the special needs child and preparing children for hospital stays and ministering to the parents during that time, before, through, and during diagnosis. She's the author of A Different Dream for My Child, Meditations for Parents of Children with Critical or Chronic Illness, as well as her book, Different Dream Parenting, A Practical Guide to Raising a Child with Special Needs. Jolene speaks at regional and national parenting and special needs conferences, and she and her husband live in Boone, Iowa, and have two children that are married. So, Jolene, those are your credentials, but you have so much more in your compelling story about how you got started in special needs ministry. And you share the story in a great way in your book, but for those who may not have read your book yet, can you tell us about your journey into the world of special needs? Just tell us your story, Jolene.
Sure, I'd be glad to. Well, my story actually began when I was about 2 years old, when my father was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, and that was way back in 1959. He pretty quickly wasn't able to walk or work or anything, but my mother was determined to keep him in our home, and he lived in our home, and we cared for him until 1983, when he went into a nursing home, and then he spent the last 14 years of his life in a nursing home and died in 1997. So I grew up as a caregiver of someone, an adult with special needs. But my parenting journey in special needs began in 1982 with the birth of our son, Alan, and we were living in northwest South Dakota in a little tiny town called Camp Crook. Very remote. The trip to the doctor, to the hospital, was 90 miles, and the first 55 miles of that were gravel.
Wow.
We had no idea our son had any issues till after he was born. About 7 hours after he was born, the doctor came in early in the morning and said he's having trouble breathing. We'd like to transfer him to Rapid City. He was born in Spearfish, South Dakota. We want to transfer him to Rapid. So they did. And we got a call from a pediatrician we had never met, whose name we had never heard, at about 11 in the morning, and he said, your child has a tracheal-esophageal fistula. That means his esophagus isn't connected to his stomach. He needs to be transferred to a major medical facility for surgery right away. Do you want him to go to Omaha or Denver?
Wow.
Well, yeah, my husband wasn't even there at the time. He'd gone off to take a shower at a friend's house, and so thankfully the only thing I could think of was my family lives in Iowa and Omaha is closer to Iowa than Denver. Send him to Omaha. So our son was life flighted. By the time he was 20 hours old, he was in surgery. The surgery was complete before he was a day old. My husband and I joined him a couple days later, and he ended up being in neonatal intensive care for a couple weeks, made a rock star recovery, came home with us. We stayed at my folks for a few weeks, then came back to remote South Dakota, and at 2 months old, our son had complications that ended up with another life flight, another trip to Omaha, another surgery, and the long and short of it is that by the time our son was 5 years old, he'd had seven surgeries and hundreds of hospital procedures. We used to joke that he'd drunk enough barium and had enough barium swallows to light up his own closet. We moved from South Dakota. We finally figured out when he was about three, you know, we probably should be closer to doctors with a kid like this. So I got a teaching job in Boone, which is only about 45 miles away from Des Moines, which has a really good children's hospital. And our son, actually, after his last surgery at five, did very well. When we moved here and once he started school, nobody really knew how much he had gone through because he was just your normal, everyday kid. At age 15, he had to have one final surgery in Kansas City, and from then on, his physical issues were pretty well taken care of, but he started having behavioral issues, and we didn't get a diagnosis on that until he was 26. He was dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder caused by all those early medical procedures. He went through treatment at a wonderful facility. It totally changed his life. He's now married. He has a wonderful job. He's finishing up college. He and his wife have a little baby boy, and they're doing very well. But through all of that, I kept thinking from when our son was tiny to when he was 26 and in treatment for PTSD, you know, how come there aren't more books on my situation? Why can't I find anything, especially in the Christian arena, to help me figure out how to deal with this as a Christian, to answer my questions about why God would do this? And finally, through a number of different circumstances, God kind of tapped me on the shoulder and said, look, I've arranged things. You're the one who's supposed to write that book. So I wrote the book. Discovery House Publishers published it. I started a blog for parents with special needs kids, and it's just kind of gone on from there.
And it is a tremendous blessing, and one that I have thought very frequently over the past few months, boy, if I could have had this when we were younger and days were a little bit darker. But it makes me imagine all of the parents who are rushing to the book and to the website to get help. And I'm going to give you a chance to give that out for our listeners, because even as someone who is on the other side of scary, scary diagnosis now, it is a daily encouragement to me to look at these and to say, oh, this is wonderful. I'm not so alone. I'm going to give you a chance to give all that out, because I think it's God has done wonderful things through you, Jolene, and I know we'll continue to. But it was really hard for me to – I had both books, and I was going back and forth between the both, and I basically had like 20 pages of notes, and I realized I didn't have that much time. So I tried to focus just on one of your books, even though they are both absolutely wonderful. But both of them talk about a different – dream, and that really resonated with me. And you write, it's not a bad dream, it's just a different dream. Well, as you and I began looking to the world of families who might be experiencing a crisis of some kind, whether they are in the hospital currently, or they are just past that into a diagnostic phase, or whether their child is in a brand new phase and they're dealing with a chronic illness, Jolene, how can we begin by talking about this idea of it being a different dream? What was in your heart when you wrote that?
Well, when I wrote it, I was thinking about, you know, how when you find out you're pregnant or a family finds out they're going to be able to adopt a child, if that child is there, you immediately start having these dreams of what it's going to be like, you know, what it'll be like to bring the baby home or pick up that baby at the adoption agency, or you know, and how you're going to watch that child grow, and what will they be when they grow up, and would my child ever be president, or, you know, will my child become a parent, and will I have grandchildren, and will we go trick-or-treating together, and all those things. And when you get a special needs diagnosis, whether it's at birth or before birth or when the child is 5 or 10 or 25, all of a sudden your dreams for that child change. Mm-hmm. And what you thought life was going to be like is not what life is going to be like. It's not what God planned for your life to be like. And so at first, you know, you have to grieve that. You have to realize, I've lost all those things. We're not going to do this. We're not going to do that. It takes time. But eventually, and all the parents I interviewed from both my books, because I try to tell many more stories than just ours in the books, almost every parent that I interviewed said at some point, and they were all of them a ways past receiving the diagnosis and had moved on to acceptance and had gone through the grieving process, but they said, you know, I wouldn't change it. Of course, yeah. I wish my child hadn't had to have this pain, but I have learned so much, and I've come to understand God's grace so much, and I've learned to depend on Him so much more, and I've become a better parent because of this. It's not, and they have that idea, it's not bad. It's just different than what I expected, but that's good.
Yes, yes. I read someplace probably a long time ago, you're probably feel much the same way as if I could just remember where I read everything I've ever read, I would be just a stellar person. But I heard it called grieving your idealized child. And you have the child of your ideals that you think you're going to have. And we do that. We stop and we say, well, it's not going to be that. And I remember those moments of it's not going to be that. And I think one of the things that can make it difficult is that the mother or the parents do that, but friends and aunts and uncles and grandparents may not have done that at the same time that the parents and the caregivers have. And it's especially can be more complicated when you start trying to take them to church. And maybe you have a wonderful, loving church family that is incredibly gracious. The way mine was, when they realized Noah was different and thought, we just really want to keep our children's minister and we want to love Noah, so we'll make changes. But they all realized a different dream even after I did. So I've said about your book, this could equip ministers and teachers so much to hear this kind of perspective. And I've said that I recommend ministers have 3 copies on their shelves at all times. 2 to give away and 1 mark for reference. I mean, you could just put it right there next to your concordance, because if you're constantly trying to help and equip these families, your book is just wonderful. And I wish I could go over every chapter and how significant so much of this is for ministers who are looking for ways to come alongside a family, or family members who are trying to come alongside a family. But I'd like to begin with the concept of advocacy, because that was one of the first things that scared me the worst. It said, well, you'll become his advocate. And I just did not know what that meant. And I remember being terrified about that for a very, very long time. And then 5 years down the road, I looked back and I thought, well, I guess I'm an advocate now. It wasn't something I was so scared about. I didn't realize I was becoming it. But when I read your book, you just start with advocacy and about how it's a role that everyone grows into. And I think that ministry staff and people coming alongside families can be valuable support for families as they grow into this terrifying role. And you have a great segment at the end of each chapter. And this is the part, Jolie, that I thought, if I had had that, how I might have slept a few more hours a night not being so frightened. And at the end of every chapter, you call it the advocate's prayer. I'd like to know more about that segment of the book and what prompted you to add that, because I think it gives some insight for people who are coming alongside these families.
Well, I think it started with how alone we felt when our son was born, you know, and we had no family around my husband, how I felt when I had to make that first decision on behalf mm-hmm. of my son. And really, you know, I was 25 years old. I was not ready for that. And my thought for years was, oh, I wish somebody would just come along and make everything right for me.
Yeah.
I wish somebody would make all the decisions and do this for me. But as I grew older and can look back, you realize that, well, when you become a parent, whether your child has special needs or not, one of your main roles is that you are an advocate for your child.
Mm-hmm.
You are the voice for your child until your child is old enough and strong enough to speak up for themselves. And but it's still so terrifying to do that alone. And so I added the prayers as a reminder that we are never alone. We always have an advocate. And to advocate well as parents, we have to find that strength that's beyond ourselves. And we have an advocate before the Father, and his name is Jesus Christ. And so because he is our advocate, all we have to do is pray and remember that we are never alone. He knows what we need. He knows how to advocate. He knows what it's like to be limited by human flesh. And he will take our prayers and present them before God. And so I think that's the main reason I added that, just that idea of you are never alone. And prayer is proof. Prayer is putting faith into action that you believe you are not alone.
And I think for ministers who are encountering a family at any stage of this, for them to recognize up front the terrifying pieces of advocacy for them, how it's different, and to acknowledge the loneliness they encounter in a time of real crisis is bad enough, but then loneliness through crisis, especially what might be a prolonged crisis and illness, that is just such an equipping thing. And for ministers who may be listening and you think you never know what to say, within this book, at the end of every chapter, in those advocates' prayers, those could just be things you echo to a family, that you say, I don't have answers. There's no need to come forward with answers for a family that physicians and no one else has. But you can come through as a representative of the Bride of Christ and say, you have an advocate, and you have a partner who has not left you alone. And I encourage everyone to really, really go out and get this book. You also talk, I just love this book. You talk in Different Dream Parenting about the illusion of control, and that as parents, we have that. And part of the process, especially of parenting a child with special needs or a child who's in a medical crisis, is letting go of the illusion of control. You know, so many people have come to me and said, can I just be frank with you, special needs moms, y'all are crazy. How do you get this way? And I said, I could explain it to you, but I'm not really sure I can help you understand it. I felt like what you said about having to let go of all control and the way you described it in the medical setting, it gives you a pit in your stomach to say, oh, my goodness, that's what's happening. Julie, you did a masterful job with that. But what advice do you have for ministers or for people as they watch parents who are struggling to reconcile their child's condition with who God is and with not having control and they have all of this happening at one time? What should they say? What can they say? And is there anything they shouldn't say as you are watching this unfold and you're coming alongside a family?
Those are really good questions. Well, first of all, I would advise ministers and lay leaders, if you are a parent and if you have a child who has reached teenagehood or beyond, you too have lost the illusion of control. Because when they get old enough to, you know, spread their wings and start getting out from your sphere of influence, that's when you begin to lose the control you thought you had, which you never really had because God is in control.
That's right.
It just happens way sooner for parents of kids with special needs and more profoundly and more deeply. You know, it's just a deeper, more intense version of what every parent experiences when their child becomes a teenager and their mind, they develop a mind of their own.
Yeah.
So to help ministers, first of all, think of how they feel when that happened to them, and think of who gave you advice that helped you, you know, remembering that, well, yes, that God is in control. So that always is not the best advice to give to a parent who's just found out their child is dying or, you know, has a terrible disease or is going to be, have a condition to live with the rest of their life. Parents don't really want to hear, well, God's in control and he let that happen.
Yes.
That may not be very comforting at that time. So what you really need to do then, instead of discussing doctrine and the sovereignty of God and all sorts of theology, you need to be there. You just need to show the people that are suffering, the family, that you care and that your church cares, and that you are there to do for them what needs to be done and be Christ to them as you can. You really need to watch the things you say. Try little things like, well, God needed your child more than you did.
Oh.
Doesn't help. Neither does, I know just how you feel, unless you know just how they feel. If you have had a child going, if you've gone through the same experience this parent and family is going through, by all means say that and be there to minister with them and help them because God has equipped you for that. But if you haven't experienced what they're going through, don't say that. It's better for you to say, I just can't imagine how you're feeling. How can I pray for you? What can I do? Don't say things like, well, God never gives you anything more than you can handle. because my personal belief is that God's always giving us more than we can handle, because that only brings us to Him.
Mm-hmm.
So watch what you say. The best thing, as I mentioned before, is just to be there. In my first book, A Different Dream for My Child, the Book of Meditations, I tell the story of one father who lost a daughter to cancer, and someone later told him that he was a pastor, and he said, I always practice the three H's in this process, and the three H's are hush, hug, and hear.
Wow.
So the first one, let's look at here first. You just need to be with that person. Be present. I'm here for you. Second, hush. It's better to just be there and say nothing than to say something that isn't helpful. So and the person who needs to talk will start talking when they're ready. And then hug. Just be there to give them physical, you know, hugs or a pat on the back or whatever they need. And beyond that, I would say, just do practical things. Think of what, you know, they're here dealing with this. What can I do that would just ease their load a little bit? We'll talk about that more as the interview goes on. And then finally, just be transparent and just say, you know, I don't understand what you're going through. And if you're struggling to understand why God would let that happen, you can say that. I don't understand why God would do this. All I do know is that God himself understands, because he lost his son once, and he was unable to help his son on the cross. And because he knows how you feel, we can pray to him with confidence, even when we don't understand why.
Absolutely. And I appreciate so much just that the simple H's, that simple idea that, you know, it's not about knowing what to do or what to say.
Yeah.
And that it's really not what I ever needed, you know, in those situations. We didn't have a lot of hospital stays when I was young. We did spend 2 weeks in the hospital last winter with some what turned out to be atypical migraines, but what presented as a stroke.
Oh, wow.
And went through a set of you know, MRIs and scans, and finally seizure studies, two separate seizure studies where we got to come home for a day or two and then go back. And, you know, having that answer for me was not what I needed. I needed someone to know I was still there.
Mm-hmm.
And, that was really it. In Chapter 7, you talk about being confident at the bedside. That's the title of that chapter, and about preparing everyone for a hospital stay. There's an art to preparing someone from a hospital stay. When we went into the hospital last winter for our first few days, we were taken on an emergency basis, and then we came back. And then I had to prepare Noah to go back for another 5 days. And, wow, that was really interesting. Trying to make preparations, and you, for anyone listening, anyone who is having a child, having any kind of a procedure, Jolene lays out do's and don'ts with wonderful precision and great ideas of things where I thought, where was this book last winter? It's absolutely wonderful. But for ministry staff or volunteers or families who may be listening, what recommendations can you give us here for preparing children and talking to them about their hospital stay, things, tests, or things that they may be going through? Can you give us what some of those recommendations are? Since we're talking about being an advocate and being confident, and maybe we've gotten through our fears, now how can we pass that on to the children?
Yeah, and it has to do with being very sensitive to where the child is at and what the child needs instead of what the adults need at that moment. And it depends on the child's level, developmental level, mm-hmm. Not necessarily age, but developmental, if you're dealing with a child with developmental delays. You know, if they're young and they're pretty much oblivious, you know, babies are up to about three years old, you don't really have to say a whole lot to them because they don't really get the idea of you know, this is going to happen next week. Tomorrow is soon enough, or when you wake up in the morning. And then, so just, you don't have to say much to those young children. The most important thing, I think, with little children, and as they get into middle childhood, is that you make sure they have some sense of control in the process. Watch what you say. You know, you might not say to them, well, are you excited about going to the hospital? The answer is no.
Yeah.
Say, well, are you ready to go to the hospital? Well, no. And then you have to say to them, well, we're going anyway. You don't really have a choice on that. So, you know, a better thing to say would be on the parents' end would be, okay, we're going to the hospital tomorrow. Do you want to take your red pajamas or your green ones? Or when they're in the hospital, which kind of popsicle do you want, grape or cherry? Or if you're a ministry leader, you might say, what, I know you're going to be in the hospital for several days. I can come either on Tuesday or Thursday. Which day would you like me to come? Or what can I bring you when I come? You know, would you rather have some happy face stickers or some pony stickers? You know, something like that. So that they can choose something they really can choose. As kids get older, you get into the adolescent and teen years, you need to recognize that they are at an age and a developmental level where they should have some say on what's going on. So you might want to ask them more about how they're feeling. You might want to ask them if they have any concerns or questions, you know, if there's anything you can do for them. Our son, before his surgery when he was 15, came down and said, okay, I'd like to plan my funeral, you know, just in case, because it was going to be a pretty big surgery. So we sat and planned his funeral, and then we went on with life. But, and actually, you know, he did fine, but I know that just gave him a feeling of control. I can't control going to the hospital, but if the worst happens, at least I have controlled what's going to happen at my funeral, which is, that's hard to wrap your head around, but it was a comfort for him. And then the other thing to really be careful of is your language and your attitude when you're around children. If you act like this is the worst thing ever, and that, oh, my gosh, this is a tragedy and blah, 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 that's what the child is going to pick up. You know, if you act like, well, this is going to be really hard and it's painful, but, you know, we're going to be there with you and we care for you and you can call me, you know, or squeeze the little puppy I gave you whenever they have to prick you with a needle, those kinds of things can help a child cope. And then watch your language. There are so many words that kids don't understand. You know, they think when you say, we're going to ICU, a child thinks the words, I see you. You know, is this a game of peekaboo? We're going to lay you on a stretcher. Oh, my gosh, they're going to stretcher? Are they going to pull my bones apart? So think of ways to say things that kids can understand. And you really have to be careful with kids that are on the autism spectrum, because
as
they get older, they are very literal.
So
those are some things, you know, to open the discussion of hospital stays with children.
Yes, and there's so much more in the book by age that was just fantastic and so wonderfully laid out. And it, you said something very important. It's about giving them ways to have healthy control. Healthy control and realistic control on, oh, that we would all take healthy control, control in healthy ways other than unhealthy ways. And it can really be a very equipping thing for a family to realize up front, here are the things we're going to be able to control, here are the things we aren't. Children's health care has come so far.
Yeah.
You know, my son was presented with a menu of what he could pick to eat. You know, it was, he did have healthy control. But I think coming alongside before they get there with those little conversations will go a long way to making them feel calm. There's a big topic here that I think is going to be a large part of conversation in 2014 for our show, and that is about ministering to siblings of children that are in a medical crisis or have a special need or a prolonged illness. And you brought out in your book that we need to be confident for them too. And like I said, this is an entire show about maybe a month long of us talking about siblings. What can you say, you know, quickly now, Jolene, about helping siblings be confident through this time of crisis?
Well, first I would recommend you visit a website called SibShop, and if you, I think it's .org, but if you just Google SibShop, you'll find it. There's a man named Don Meyer who has done a lot of work in helping siblings of kids with special needs, and that website is chock full of really good resources and books and forums for kids. So you can look that over and then be able to direct families and children to that. And then I think the main thing that you can do for siblings is inquire of the parents, you know, what the plans are for the siblings, and then ask if there's anything that you can do to make that more practical. Can you help arrange for carpooling to school or to church activities, or where is your child going to be staying? Can we have a contact number so I can call once in a while and see how your child's doing? So that if, especially if you already have a good relationship with the siblings, you can be kind of a normal thread, something that they're used to, a face that they're used to, that keeps reappearing and assuring them that, yeah, you know, things are kind of different right now, but this part is the same. You know, my church is still there and the people in my church still care about me. You might, as a church, just send some care packages to the kids, the siblings, you know, put together a little basket of things that would be fun for kids to do. You might offer even to drive the kids up to the hospital to visit, and, you know, if that would work, because that can be a very healthy thing for kids. Or you can, if the child is there for a while, you can offer to take the siblings off, you know, to just walk around in the hospital for a little bit instead of having to sit in their sibling's room all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So just think of those practical things that you can do for kids and help them keep their life as normal as possible.
Yeah, as long as we're talking about being at the hospital and visiting, can you give us some tips on how to make a hospital visit to a family with a child that may be sick? Some things that you know automatically that would be good to take, timing of a visit, how long to stay, things like that.
First of all, find out when it's good to be there. It's always good to check with the family and see, do they have like a point person who's in charge of communications, somebody who helps with their schedule, because there's nothing more aggravating than having had your kid go up for an x-ray and then come back and have some blood work done, and they're finally going to settle down and have 4 hours to rest, and you're going to take a nap, and then your phone starts ringing.
Yes.
And it's someone very well-meaning who wants to know how you're doing and what they can do, but you really need to get some sleep. So often I advise families to put somebody else in charge of everything, you know, of all the communications, and then they field the phone calls and they can ask your questions and get back to you about when is a good time to come visit and is there anything special that they need. It really is helpful. One of the nicest things that was ever done for us was when our son had surgery in Kansas City when he was 15. My husband and I were both going to go down, and the night before we were leaving, my husband ran a fever, and it was a high fever by morning, so he couldn't go with us. So I was alone with my son down in a hospital 4 hours from home. I had a cousin who lived in the area, and she came and sat with me, and then some people from our home church knew another pastor in the area. Actually, two families did this, and they called those pastors, and one of them came and sat with us through Alan's entire surgery. And there was an ice storm that day. You know, it was really nasty. And then one of the pastors came at a later date and brought Alan, like, I think, a gym bag with a monogram towel or something. So, yeah. You know, if you can just, but having that person there while your child is in surgery is really helpful, because it's so hard to keep your mind from racing. Well, why haven't they contacted me? What could be going wrong? Is my child alive? What's happening now? And you start these worst-case scenarios. But if there's somebody there to talk to you and just keep your mind off that, it really is helpful. And you know, you can be just kind of lighthearted, and it doesn't have to be grim, just chatter, you know. It also can be very helpful to bring practical things like a care package. Again, a really special memory I have when our son was foreign surgery in Des Moines with some friends of ours, and he had a history of a lot of surgeries in his life. So they brought a picnic down, and we went outside into the courtyard. It was in June, and we were able to take our son in his little wagon, and we ate a picnic outside one night during that hospital stay, and that was so nice, you know, to be out of the, it just felt like a little normal all of a sudden.
Mm-hmm.
So anything like that is helpful.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, just that there's still a world outside that hospital or medical center, because it becomes everything. You know,
it does, yeah.
Quickly, really quickly. You know, we were only there about 2 weeks, but I was amazed at how disconnected I felt from everything outside. And it was around this time last year, and I remember thinking we were there when they put up the decorations for the holidays, you know, at the hospital, and I thought, oh my goodness, it's Christmas. It's going to be Christmas soon, you know, and especially this time of year, you know, when everyone else may be doing their normal things. But there's this family that's suddenly even more not normal than they usually are.
That's true.
We always say that normal's not even a setting on our dryer, you know, but
yeah,
we were
exactly.
Really not normal there.
And, you know, that reminds me of something that people can do at holidays that is really helpful. You know, kids, one of the things they really enjoy are all the decorations for the holidays. And so another nice thing church people could do would be offer to come in and decorate the child's room for the holiday if they're there for the long haul. I had one mom that said her friends would come in and do that. They would just, because she didn't have the energy, but they knew that Chandler would enjoy the decorations. So they brought everything in and just decorated his room.
That's so wonderful.
Isn't that sweet?
That's a little bit of normalcy, a little bit of hope, you know, and you're still a part of everything that's going on outside this one little room. This segues nicely into what happens to you after you spend so many days into a hospital. And you call it the mama tiger, which I thought, how sweet that was, how she phrased that. You know, you don't have to be there very long. They were trying to stimulate a seizure to see if my son had a seizure disorder with onset of puberty is kind of what they were trying to get to. And, of course, they had the lights on, and they brought in a noise machine, and we couldn't turn the lights off even to sleep, and I had to be there to record a seizure should it happen, and then they brought in white noise, and I remember turning to a nurse and saying, you know, he doesn't seem to be having a seizure, but I'm real close. Real close. About to lose my mind. And I'm sure they designated Mama Tiger in that room that day. What kinds of things do parents struggle with during these times, and how can churches help them practically?
Well, first of all, they're exhausted. You know, you're sleeping usually on a cot next to your child in a hospital room, and so you don't get good sleep. I have been in the hospital during tornado warnings, during fire drill, you know, where there was a fire somewhere, so the fire alarms were going off. I have developed my own ear infections, you know, laying under a cold air vent in my child's room, you know. So you're exhausted. Your body is wearing down. You're prone to get sick. The lack of normalcy and lack of normal routine and having to wait for everybody to get there. Talk about no sense of control. You wait all day for the doctor to come, and you wait, and you just wait. You can't speed things up. And you can't fix things. That, I think, is the hardest thing for parents. My child is sick, and I'm the person who's supposed to kiss his boo-boos and put on the Band-Aid and help them get up and go out to play, and I can't fix this. And it is so hard. So knowing that's how the parents feel, there are some things that I think church leaders can do, or just the church family, that you can empower your church family to do. Offer, if you've got some people in your church maybe who are have some medical training, EMT, nurse, you know, doctor, whatever, or are very comfortable or have had a special needs child with a similar issue, offer to bring them in to be trained to sit with your child and know what to look for, and this could be in the hospital or at home, to know what to look for, and they will come and sit with your child for a certain period of a day once a week or twice a week, so the parent can just get out and maybe go take a walk or do anything, you know, go down and have a cup of coffee without having to wonder, am I going to have to get back in 5 minutes? Will my child wake up? So you could do that. Another thing that you could do is just go in and say, all right, or let them know ahead of time, I'm going to come at such and such a time, and if you have anything you need bought, you know, if you have a shopping list of personal items, of things for your kids, whatever you need, groceries for home, whatever, give me the list and I'll go grocery shopping for you, or I'll do your shopping, and I'll bring back what you need at the hospital, and I'll take to your house what you need there, or whatever. Another thing that I think can be really helpful is ask if you can come pick up their dirty laundry and bring them new clothes.
Oh, isn't that the truth?
Yeah, because you know, sometimes you don't have time to even get a suitcase, or you end up there longer, like your situation, longer than you expected. So just fresh clothes. Can I pick up your mail and just bring it up to you so you can look through it? Anything else? I remember having to tell calling my friend when our son ended up going for treatment for PTSD. I said, okay, here's going to be my address. I need you to go to this dresser in my house and get these cords because I need my phone charger. I need this. I need all these electronic things so I can keep working while he was going through treatment.
Yes, the phone charger. My phone went dead quickly. I could not believe there was not a phone charger to be had. Yes.
So, and I mentioned other things, you know, take a party to them, decorate the room. You could offer to scoop snow, mow the lawn, care for their pets, you know, haul their kids, their other kids where they need to be. Just think practically so that you can help take away all those other stresses and they can just deal with the hospital thing for now.
Absolutely, absolutely. One of the sections of the book that touched me most was where you talked about being confident in prayer, and I think that was because there have been so many times that at the end of you come to the end of yourself, and that's where you are, is with God alone, talking to Him. And you wrote that recognizing God at work isn't easy, especially in the hospital, and neither is trusting God's control in an environment where you feel powerless. And you also wrote that each of your trips to the hospital honed your ability to recognize God's voice. And if there's a place for a ministry, I think this just might be it. When you're coming into a situation where you see a mom or a dad or even a child that's just at the end of themselves. But it's so delicate. So my question is, how can friends and family and ministers and churches respect where a family is in fear and maybe in grief, but yet still be there to help them hone that ability to hear God's voice? It's a special, delicate place to be, but if anybody can do it, I think that's where the bride of Christ is the most equipped.
Mm-hmm. And I think the way we do that is just like what you said. We have to be there. Whether we can be there physically, whether we let them know that we are with them in prayer. I've been in churches where they've done this for moms when they go into labor, but we could do that as churches too, where we set up a prayer calendar, a 24-hour prayer calendar, and people signed up for an hour of prayer. And then when the mom went into labor, you'd call the first person, and then, you know, we'd pass that off and call the next person until the baby was born. Well, we could do that for parents and families of children who are in the hospital or having surgery or dealing with something. Let them know, we're lifting you up in prayer, and I will be praying specifically for you from this time to this time. I'll be thinking of you other times, but this time is dedicated to you. Another thing we can do is send texts, send emails. If the person has a CaringBridge page or a CarePages page where they leave updates where they put the updates for their child, you can also go in and leave comments. And so leave comments there. You know, tell them how you've been praying. Say, you know, I was thinking of you. You came to mind at this time, and so I stopped and prayed for you. Is there any other thing I can do to pray for you? And then if you can actually physically be there and talk to people, you're going to be able to help them kind of process what they're going through. You know, like when our son was in the hospital at 2 months old down in Rapid City, one of the nurses turned out to be a classmate of my sister's from high school. And we were hundreds of miles away. And that was just so comforting. I didn't think right then, oh, God's with me. God spoke to me through this person. I didn't think that then. But her presence was comfortable. But if I had had, if my pastor had been there, had been able to be there or something, and he or a friend, they might have said, isn't that amazing? That your nurse was this person that was from your hometown. Isn't it wonderful how God, you know, just lets us know he's with us in those subtle ways? We can kind of be alongside to interpret in that way. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. It's it reminds me of the proverb. Some things are just apples of gold and settings of silver. They're the most simple things.
Yes.
Small kindnesses. Small words, and I guess I would say you just think small.
Right. And the more, you know, my favorite verse in the Bible is Zechariah 4:10, who has despised the day of small things. And I think of that every day. You know, what small thing can I do today that over the long haul is going to make a difference in the life of someone else? Because if I keep doing small thing after small thing over a long period of time, God's much more likely to speak through me and through the relationship I've developed that way than if I do one big thing and never show up again.
Yes.
And so the more you can do with sending cards, texting somebody. I have a friend who lost her husband about a year and a half ago, and two or three times a week I just send her a text saying, thinking of you. I don't see her very often, but I just send her those texts so that she knows somebody's there. And when we do that, we're putting ourselves in a place to be used by God so someone else can hear his voice. And so that's how we help others hone their ability to hear God. We develop a relationship with them through little things that show them God is with them in everything.
Absolutely. I don't think it can be better said. Well, we, in chapter 9, which was called Calm in the Family, which made me laugh a little bit, you talk about what you call so aptly a profound change in dynamics in a family that undergoes this kind of experience, and that there are changes in roles and expectations that can create chaos. And part of it is part of the grieving process, but some things are just very practical pieces that begin to happen that you just didn't have a plan for. And you detail frustration and grief and guilt and anxiety very, very well. Can you give churches and ministers and friends an insider's perspective into what is happening to families that are in crisis at home? What kind of things happen at home as far as different responses by different spouses and the different change in dynamics, and what can be done to come along and help with that?
Mm-hmm. Well, if I detailed it well, it's because I had so much experience at being frustrated, guilty, and anxious. You know,
yeah.
I kind of have my own little crown on those things that I wear way too often. And looking at this, I think this is where having had my father with an illness really helps, because I experienced this as a child with a parent and then as a parent with a child. And in my childhood, it completely flip-flopped our family dynamics. My father had been the breadwinner. He was a gregarious, outgoing man. He was a county extension agent. And in rural Iowa, that's like about the top of the hill in 1989.
Yeah.
And my mom was a stay-at-home mom, and she wanted to be a stay-at-home mom, and all of a sudden my dad couldn't work anymore. Mom had to go back to work. She had three kids. She had to continue her education. and she had to care for a husband with special needs. And it affected her. It affected my dad, who, of course, how could you not have some problems with depression when that thing would happen to you, plus multiple sclerosis, which was his disease, leads to a lot of depression anyway. That's a component of it. And for us kids, it was like, all right, Dad used to be the one who, if we were naughty, gave us the spanking. And now it's Mom. And it used to be that if Mom was going to spank us, that's good because Dad spanked harder. And now Mom, or now my dad is home when I get home from school. And so there's all those things that children are going through. And my mother was extremely determined to make the world think that we were handling it all very well on our own. And she was a remarkable woman. But if there was one thing she did wrong, it was she tried to do everything on her own, and it led to a lot of stress and too much expectation on we children that kids shouldn't have. So what I would say most of all is no matter what a family says about their special needs situation, that they're doing just fine, they probably aren't. And that you are going to need to keep asking questions and keep offering to help and coming up with creative ways to help and earning their trust so that they will let you help. And if there's anything I want leaders to hear, that's it. And then beyond that, you just need to remember that different family members will grieve differently, about their child or about what's happened. A mother may grieve differently than the father. They may express the grief differently so that one spouse thinks the other one isn't grieving, but they're just not grieving the same way. And so you may need to talk to those parents or separately sometimes to figure out where they're at and then come together if you're going to try and do any kind of counseling. So those would be the big things. And I guess the other thing that would really help here is that if you know of anyone else in your congregation or in the larger body of Christ that has gone through a similar situation, has a child with a similar illness or a similar scenario, talk to that person and see if they would be willing to come alongside and maybe support or possibly even mentor that family or that parent, because that's probably going to be the most effective means of reaching them.
And I like what you said about earning their trust. There's something about what happens when your world is turned upside down that it doesn't seem like you should, but you want to be handling it. It's your desire to be handling what has come your way. And you fear what people are going to think about what you're going through. And about how things may be completely falling apart and how you may be just so tired or so angry or so grieved, but you don't feel like maybe you can share that.
Mm-hmm.
And what I heard in what you were saying was listen. Listen,
yeah.
listen. When I took pastoral counseling for my undergraduate, the professor had a degree in counseling and had, a terminal degree, and he came in and he said, I could teach this course a lot of ways, but I'm going to teach you people how to listen. You need to know how to listen, not to have an answer. He goes, if you came in thinking I was going to teach you how to have an answer when you go make a terrible visit, I hate to tell you, this is going to be about listening.
Yeah, and you have to listen with your eyes, too. You have to be watching, not just hearing what they're saying, but what are their gestures saying and their facial expressions and their body language, because that can tell you a lot.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Jolene, if you just had one piece of advice that we have not mentioned that you could give to ministries that have a family that is either in a hospital crisis or is entering a diagnostic period, whether they're at the hospital or at home, what other piece of advice would you give to ministries that are seeking to meet this family where they are?
I would say don't quit. Don't stop meeting their needs. Be there during the crisis, but be there after the crisis too. Keep checking on the families, because when you have a child with special needs, it's a lifelong situation. The crisis may be over, but there are going to be ongoing issues that parents are going to be dealing with, and they need your support throughout those, even if it's just sending them a card now and then or giving them a call to let them know that you're thinking about them. Just don't quit. Always be there. Always let them know that you care. Always extend the hand of Christ to them.
Absolutely. Amen. It is a marathon and not a sprint. That is
right
for sure on the other side of it. Well, I thank you so much. Can you give out your contact info? You've already mentioned some of it, but can you give that out again for our guests who want to follow you, any kind of Facebook or Twitter, your blog, your website? Can you give that out for us now?
Sure. If you go to my website, it is differentdream.com. And if you go to that, you can get to my Facebook page and my Twitter page, sign up for my RSS feed and for my newsletter. My Twitter handle is Jolene Philo, and that's JoleneThilo. You can find me under the same name at Facebook. I also have an author page that's called Different Dream on Facebook. And I'm on Pinterest. And again, if you just, the wonderful thing about my name is that if you just, you know, search for Jolene Philo, there aren't a lot of us out there, and you'll go straight to me.
That's right. That's right.